78-3175CR, State v. Stephen L. Jensen, James L. Fullen, Assistant State Public Defender, arguing for Mr. Jensen.
Thank you, Your Honor, for moving the argument to this date to accommodate my vacation in Arizona. Unfortunately,
tell us more. Yeah.
Is that why we did this?
I gained by giving my opportunity to present my first argument for a client in this court. I lost, and then all the friends of the court that signed that brief are all unavailable today because of university spring break. So I will be giving the entire argument for Mr. Jensen. My client, Stephen Jensen, was awakened at 5 a.m. by his 10-week-old son crying inconsolably. Mr. Jensen checked the baby's diaper, heated and offered a bottle, walked the baby around the room, placed it in its favorite chair, put a pillow under it. The baby just screamed louder. Mr. Jensen became angry and shook the baby. The screaming stopped suddenly, and Mr. Jensen realized that it was having difficulty breathing. He called 911 within 1 minute, and the emergency squad arrived, administered CPR, and saved the baby's life. However, the baby was permanently blinded. This case offers this court an opportunity to clarify a longstanding problem in substantive criminal law. That problem is, what is utter disregard for life? We know it's more than criminal recklessness because it's the element that distinguishes and aggravates recklessness from ordinary recklessness to first degree. But what more exactly? Recklessness requires awareness that one's conduct creates a substantial and unreasonable risk of death or great bodily harm. And all the briefs in this case discuss the meaning of utter disregard for life, the element that distinguishes and differentiates reckless from aggravated reckless. In preparing for this argument, I studied those briefs, particularly the non-party brief for Professors Dickey, Smith, Schultz, and Kempinen, filed after the briefs of the parties. And I have come to this conclusion. I urge this court to clarify by defining utter disregard for human life as indifference to a substantial probability that one's conduct will cause death. This incorporates several suggestions in the non-party brief of the law professors. First, an elevated risk, represented by the word substantial probability. Secondly, an elevated seriousness of harm, represented by the words cause death. And thirdly, subjective indifference to, that is, not caring about, not concerned for, that risk.
Counsel, will you give that definition again, please?
Indifference to a substantial probability that one's conduct will cause death.
Thank you.
With your permission, I'd like to briefly elaborate on those three elements.
Now, how does that differ before you do that? Are you adopting the amicus brief or not?
I'm incorporating parts of that. I think the amicus brief doesn't take a position. It says, here's various ways you could define it. Please make it clear.
Well, the amicus brief says, or at least what they think is difference. They say, don't do it. Subjective or objective. They're only labels. And if objective is understood to be reasonable person, it's not helpful because it fails to make clear that the circumstances which show an attitude of indifference. And then this is their more common sense approach. It suggests the words mean exactly what they say, that there are circumstances, I'm reading on page 10, second full paragraph, that there are circumstances, that is objectively existing facts, which show utter disregard for human life, where show does not require that the actor is subjectively aware of more than is required for simple recklessness. The degree of dangerousness and culpability expressed by the phrase under circumstances which show utter disregard for human life, evidences an attitude of indifference to, which may include the awareness, which is in the reckless definition, the harm that may result and the likelihood of it resulting from the conduct.
I am asking that you define utter disregard as indifference to a substantial probability of death, I do not use the word subjective or objective, but forced to clarify, I would say, indifferent means you have to be aware of a substantial probability that one's conduct will cause death.
So it's a conscious indifference.
Conscious indifference, that phrase has been used in many cases interpreting this statute and its predecessors. But you can infer that conscious indifference from all the circumstances. The existing jury instructions tell the jury to consider in deciding whether there was utter disregard, what the defendant was doing, why he was doing it, how dangerous it was, how obvious the danger was, and whether the defendant showed any regard for life. Those are circumstances from which a jury can infer this subjective
counsel. Well, and I don't mean to deviate from your presentation, but we have the Wisco case, 73 case, and of course then there was a revision of the statutes in 88. But would you tell me why you think Wisco is not still good law in this state?
I think it is, but I think that you can, by reading Wiso, we've both cited it.
Wiso,
that'll be ESO. I believe that's the one.
You're right.
And depending on which paragraph you're in, it can be read either way. I mean, there are times when, the one phrase that has been relied upon by the state is it's, you don't have to show that the person had a depraved mind. You only have to show that his conduct evinced a depraved mind. Now, that could be read to mean there's no subjective awareness requirement, but reading on in WESO and reading it all in context, it defines what a depraved mind is as a conscious indifference to an extreme risk. So I think the obviousness of the danger is the most important factor in my case. If it's very, very clear that the conduct is going to cause an elevated risk of death, then you can convict of this. But in my case, the circumstances show that it was not so clear.
Well, are you relying on pre or post injury? Because you, at least in your brief, you seem to place a great deal of reliance on the fact that he called 911 after the shaking. But your definition seems to diminish post activity.
I think all the circumstances are relevant. The fact that he dialed 911 knowing he would become a suspect is one piece of evidence that he was not indifferent to the baby's life. The fact that he tried to calm the baby before he shook it are also facts.
But let's stay on the right. Post-activity. I agree with you that his activity after he shook the baby showed that he was not indifferent. But shouldn't the focus of the conduct be on the defendant's activity prior to the injury?
I think,
or at least a lot greater weight given to that.
Well, that's why my brief talks about the prior activity. I mean, the point of this is, first degree is aggravated. It's worse than regular reckless. Now, how is it worse and why is it worse? It's worse because there's an elevated level of culpability because the defendant disregards an elevated risk of an elevated harm. And if the defendant isn't aware of the elevated risk of death, then it's reckless, but it isn't first-degree reckless. That's what I'm arguing here, that the defendant has to consciously disregard, be indifferent to, be unconcerned about a risk of fatality, really. I'm also asking that this court define utter disregard for life as a more serious harm than utter disregard for life or safety. That isn't what the statute says. It says life. And therefore, I think unless Mr. Jensen knew that his conduct could kill C.D., he can't be convicted of this. Just as you've overturned jury verdicts in Seidler, Balestrieri, and Wagner, because the conduct taken as a whole showed some regard for life. And I think what happened here was we learned when Dr. Perloff testified at trial just how vulnerable infants are to shaking. It's worse, said Dr. Perloff, than dropping them out of a third-story window. Now, if Mr. Jensen had dropped C.D. out of a third-story window, I wouldn't be here, because the risk of that is quite obvious. No, everyone knows you can't do that. I think shaking is not so obvious. It's not an obvious risk. Most people don't know what Dr. Perloff knows, which is babies' brains, when they're this young, are like unset jello. And they have a lot of little axons in them. And if you start shaking them, those axons get stirred up and they break. And then the brain can't communicate with the body and tell it to take the next breath.
Counsel, I'm just trying to visualize what the defendant did know. He knew he was not accustomed to taking care of his child. But he was told, as I understand it, in facts, by the mother, you have to hold the baby's head this way. You have to be very careful with the baby's neck. Now, knowing that, and then doing what he did, it just seems to me that when the jury can't look into somebody's, there's an instruction about you can't look into a person's mind, which they have to look at it from a, and I hate to use it, an objective, an understandable, reasonable standard, objective. And that's what troubles me about changing the argument and making it something that juries will be somewhat confused as to how they are to view these facts.
I think that the facts that you've cited, together with another one, which is that Mr. Jensen told one of the officers that came with the ambulance to take the baby, that he hoped the baby's neck wasn't injured because babies' necks are fragile. He knew that babies' necks are fragile. And
he threw him out of a tree.
And I think that establishes recklessness. He took an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm. So, and he pled to a reckless offense. So I don't think there's any question that he was reckless. What he wasn't is indifferent to an elevated risk of fatal results. That's what the record does not show. The aggravated element has to be something more than regular recklessness, and it should be something less than intent, which is awareness that one's conduct is, quote, practically certain to cause the result. That's intent. So it's the duty of this court, I believe, to fashion a definition of utter disregard that's somewhere in between. And I'm suggesting...
In between what?
In between intent, which is awareness that one's conduct is practically certain to cause the result, and ordinary recklessness, which is awareness of a substantial and unreasonable death or great bodily harm.
How long did it take between the shaking and the 911 call?
About 30 seconds. 30 seconds between the time that he shook the baby, the crying suddenly stopped, he observed that the baby was having difficulty breathing. And he put it on the floor to see if that would help, but it didn't. And so within 30 seconds of realizing that the baby was having trouble breathing, which, according to the testimony, was relatively instantaneous, the baby stopped when the shaking happened, stopped crying.
How long was it between the shaking and the time that the defendant started lying about what had happened?
I don't recall the record, whether he lied when he called 911 or when the ambulance got there.
But if he said in the 911 call...
Yeah, I dropped the baby, the baby fell, or something like that.
Now, what inference should a fact finder draw from the fact that he started lying almost instantly?
Well, I think the lying, it's not good, but it does not... It doesn't really tell us anything about Mr. Jensen's awareness of the risk of fatality here. He knew the baby wasn't breathing and he better get an ambulance there. He also knew that he would probably become a suspect, so maybe he did begin to lie at that point. But it doesn't tell us what his mental state was when he caused this injury. It just doesn't. And I don't excuse or condone how he behaved, but I think the question is, did he realize that this might kill the baby? And I don't think we can say it did. Which of us, having a child crying unconsolably and won't stop, despite the fact we tried various strategies, it just keeps crying louder and louder. I think we're biologically programmed as human beings to respond to that, to get upset, to become agitated, and that's what happened here. He became agitated. He became angry. He said, I want this baby to stop crying, maybe if I shake it. But did he know that that could kill it? Did he know what Dr. Perloff knew, that this was extremely risky, worse than dropping the baby out a third-story window?
We can't impose some sort of medical or clinical standard here, though, that he has to have the awareness of a physician about the consequences. That's not an appropriate rule, is it?
I think a jury or a judge, like Judge Fiedler, could infer, you know, from the circumstances, yes or no on utter disregard. In fact, that happened. But I think the law was so unclear that poor Judge Fiedler, I put his decision in the brief because, you know, he read a lot of cases. And you can tell, I can tell, that he's struggling with this. Does this meet it or does it not? And, I mean, he cites Wieso. He thinks that's the most important case. But both Greg and I cite Wieso. So I think the important thing is, did the judge clearly understand what utter disregard was? I agree with the professors that you write on a clean slate. This is your first opportunity to clarify that since the legislature clarified that first-degree reckless is an aggravated form of regular reckless. Before that, you had utter disregard, no, conduct imminently dangerous to another, evincing a depraved mind regardless of life, and then you had reckless conduct. And it wasn't as clear as it now is that it's recklessness plus.
Counsel, I want to return to the definition offered in the non-party brief on page 10 that was previously referred to by the Chief. And it seems to me that your definition is the same. You use the term substantial probability rather than likelihood, and you use the term will cause death rather than will result in harm. But in essence, both require an indifference, both require a likelihood or substantial probability, both require that the conduct, and both require that will result in harm or will cause death. Is your definition the same as the non-party brief?
I think in that sense that it is. I think the non-party brief offers you the opportunity to do less than that, but I pulled this idea from studying that brief. And by substantial probability, I want you to, I mean, that's been defined by this court twice in recent years in 980 cases, Curiel and Keene, says, quote, much more likely than not. So it's an elevated risk, much more likely than not. Secondly, I want to focus on death because the statute talks about disregard for life. It doesn't talk about safety. So that's another piece. Now, the third piece is the indifference. And I think that the important element here is that it isn't obvious that if you shake a baby, even though you shake it hard, you could kill it. I don't think most of us know that. Maybe in 10 years, we will. I know that the parents of shaken babies are forming a support group to get the word out to people. You can't do this to an infant.
Isn't that a question for a jury to decide, not for this court?
It is a question for a jury to decide, and I think Judge Fiedler did what he thought a jury would do. I mean, he conscientiously read the jury instructions and talked about it. So, yes, it's for a jury to decide. But
so
I don't
what
think
you're asking us to do is send this case back for a new trial.
Correct. I'm asking you to reverse the conviction of first degree. And when you do that, you'll probably remand it for resentencing on the other count in which probation was imposed. And I think the sentence structure would be implicated by such a reversal. It could open the door to re-prosecution, either of first-degree reckless or perhaps of second. There's various things that will happen to my client, but the first step is for you to vacate his conviction of this, just as you vacated Seidler's conviction in 1964, just as you vacated Balistrieri and Wagner. Juries concluded that first-degree was shown, but this court said no. As a matter of law, the conduct doesn't show utter disregard for life. Reversed. You have that power. You've used it three times.
Well, are you asking us to say that as a matter of law, this is not first degree?
Yes, but if you can't go there,
that's a pretty
you could say, okay, but the jury, I mean, we were now going to define utter disregard XYZ, and we remand for application of this definition. That's another option that you have. I would, of course, prefer that you just say, as a matter of law, this wasn't. But if you think that a jury could get there under your definition, you could remand and allow that to take place. I just think that the law is so unclear. WESO goes both ways. You know, this is the first case to come up since the revision. That Judge Fiedler, I don't think he was unreasonable, but I don't think he had the benefit of what I'm asking you to clarify.
Now, you covered this in your 1989 Wisconsin law review. You and Professors Dickey and Schultz. You were then executive director of the Judicial Council.
And I was the reporter for this committee.
Right, and reporter for this committee. So, how does your argument today fit? Maybe it's an unfair question, but I'm asking it anyway. How does it fit with Page's, well, at least on my Westlaw printout, 17 and 18, but it deals with 1355 through, let's see, 1360. Where you talk about the aggravating factors, circumstances which show utter disregard for human life. I was on the council then. I remember a long discussion about this.
Well, I think it's quoted in the page 6 of the state's brief. A matter which remains unclear is whether the aggravating factor adds anything to the mental element beyond the awareness of the risk. We admitted that we didn't resolve that problem. Maybe the committee couldn't agree. I'm not sure we had as well briefed a presentation as this. Anyway, that committee decided utter disregard is all we need, and that's the best. We're asking this court to make up for that and to express more clearly. We didn't have Curiel then, which expresses a level of risk that's in between reckless and intentional. There's some things that have happened since that this court could build on and use in a definition that could then be applied. Obviously, juries and judges are going to have to apply your definition of this, but the jury instructions that we have now don't really talk about what utter disregard is. They instruct the jury to look at the circumstances, what he was doing, why, how dangerous, how obvious the danger. It gives them a way to decide it, but they don't say what it really is, and I think you could say it's a substantial probability of a risk of fatality, and that the defendant must be aware of that. And then, I think there would be greater clarity, as Professor Dickey has urged.
I'm troubled still by the concept of indifference. You say that it requires, that the word conscious indifference, at least that's how you put it in your brief. And yet, then you say, I guess I'm thinking out loud, my question. Then you say that this is less than criminal intent, but more than ordinary recklessness. Is that going to be, if you were writing the opinion, is that how you would write it? And simply say that by conscious indifference, we mean something less than criminal intent, but something more than ordinary recklessness? Or can we do better than that?
I think you can do better than that, because it's clear from the structure of these crimes that that's what it is.
Okay, how would you do better than that if you were the scrivener? How would you...
Well, you could say before you defined it that obviously this is something the legislature intended to aggravate recklessness, but not the intent. And the old cases kind of do that. There's like this constructive intent and all those things. You don't need that anymore because now we have intent clearly defined in the statute. We have recklessness clearly defined, and then we have something in between, penalty structure-wise, that's aggravated recklessness, that uses these words.
Well, does it require some degree of knowledge?
Yes, it requires the defendant to be aware that his conduct could kill. That's what I'm urging you to say. The defendant must subjectively be aware that his conduct could kill. However, a jury can infer that subjective awareness from all the circumstances. If he uses a weapon, if he shoots a gun, if he sticks a knife, he drops the baby out the third floor, you don't have much problem here. It's like any intent inference by a jury. But when all he does is shake somebody that he can't get to be quiet, and he's not a pediatrician that understands about infant brains, I think it presents a much closer question, more like Seidler. Although Seidler involved a four-year-old and a throwing, not a shaking of an infant, it's not the same. But this court has always been bothered that a parent or a parental figure that overdoes parental discipline really doesn't have the mental state required for what used to be second-degree murder, what's now aggravated recklessness. It's not that the circumstances of this case, both leading up to and afterwards, show a loving father that really did care whether this baby lived or died. He was just trying to make it be quiet, and he lost it. And I think any of us could do that. So it's not an elevated culpability. Any of us could, I think, lose it if we can't get the baby to be quiet. I know public defenders that I've talked to about this case that said, you know, I almost did that once. Called my mom. She said, put the baby down. Put the baby down. I'm not talking to you until you put the baby down.
So the jury, excuse me, counsel, I'm just thinking that you're asking us, so we have an adult, and maybe we would have a 14, 12-year-old babysitter whether there were one shake, eight shakes, in this case, 10 to 12 shakes, it seems to me it's going to be a more confusing standard for the jury, if that's what you're asking.
Well, it can't be a bright line rule. The jury has to look at all the circumstances. I just think we could do a little better than we do explaining what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Fullen. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Posner-Weber, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. The state is asking this court to hold that the utter disregard element of Section 940.23 sub 1 does not require the state to prove that the defendant actually, subjectively, realized and disregarded a substantial risk of causing death. We are asking you to hold that the state is required to meet an objective standard, that the state must prove that the conduct of the defendant and the surrounding circumstances, as generally considered by mankind, are sufficient to show utter disregard for human life. The language is taken from Leeson at page 411.
How do you differ then from Mr. Fullen, and how do you differ from the amicus brief?
I think we differ from Mr. Fullen's position because I understand Mr. Fullen to be arguing for a subjective standard. I don't see what he presents to you today as being substantively different from what he suggested in his brief, and I think that became clear during questioning. I think that the defendant is asking for a subjective standard.
What difference does it make if you can infer the subjective standard from the circumstances? That's the same thing you're asking for, because you meet objective conduct by the defendant and the surrounding circumstances is generally considered. So you never can open the guy's mind. What you have to do is say, hey, what a reasonable person.
Well, and perhaps Mr. Jensen's counsel can clarify and rebuttal, but I understand their position to be that we're charging a defendant in a situation like this with almost actual knowledge, or proving the same type of knowledge that Dr. Perloff had in this case.
Well, it's conscious indifference, but you can infer conscious indifference from all of his circumstances. That's his position.
But I understand the argument to go further than that. I understand the argument to be virtually that the state would need to prove that the defendant had the type of technical knowledge that Dr. Perloff presented to the jury here. And I don't think that's required. It certainly is not required under WESO, and I don't even understand the more extreme examples of case law from this court that talk about subjective awareness to go as far as what Mr. Fullen is suggesting this court should do today.
Well, certainly you're saying that the defendant, or at least a reasonable person in the defendant's position, had some degree of awareness or some degree of knowledge that his conduct would cause this.
By importing the criminal recklessness language into this statute, there is a mental element insofar as criminal recklessness is concerned. That isn't at issue here. Mm-hmm. The utter disregard language, I think, at least the most recent pronouncements in WESO by the Court of Appeals in Edmonds and by the Court of Appeals in Jensen, says we look at the totality of the circumstances and we compare that we consider that in light of what a reasonable person in the defendant's position would know. Edmonds gives a good analytical framework for analyzing the question of whether utter disregard is present in a case. What I would also ask this court to do is adopt as an analytical framework the type of analysis that is advised in the jury instructions, 1250, Edmonds at page 77 of that decision, and Wieso at page 410 of that decision.
The problem that I have with that position, also, is that it seems to me, at least what I'm hearing from you, is that you're saying that this aggravated element, because it's an aggravated element, because for to prove this crime, not only must you prove that the defendant knew, because that's an element of recklessness, not only must the state prove that the defendant knew, but the state must also prove that the defendant should have known. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
If you adopt an objective standard where we're using a reasonable person analysis, yeah, there is an element of the should have known. And I certainly think that's satisfied under the facts of this case.
But if the jury has already determined, fact finder has determined that the defendant knew, what sense does it make that the state has to prove that he should have known? You've already shown that.
Okay, I see what you're saying. If we can import into the context of utter disregard the knowledge element of criminal recklessness and say that whenever we've established criminal recklessness, we've also established the requisite for utter disregard.
So what more are you asking us? That's why I'm not satisfied to simply say it's an objective standard, because I should have known, which is a should have known standard, a reasonable person, because you've already proved, you've gotten to first base already. First, second, and third. And the question is, are you going to get home? And you've got to prove that additional aggravated element. So what does that additional aggravated element require in addition to should have known?
Wieso seems to suggest that we look, as I say, we look at that totality of the circumstances. And the language that I like in all of this is at page 412 of Wieso. Tells the fact finders to look at the excessiveness of the conduct in relation to its purpose. I'm quoting here. The nature of the conduct and the disregard for the possible result in such conduct evinces an unreasonable mind in that it lacks balance, a moral sense, and judgment, and hence evinced utter disregard.
So it's really not a should have known standard then. It's a degree of knowledge that the conduct will be done.
Certainly no more of an awareness of risk than what you have in the criminal recklessness. But I mean, I see the requisite level of understanding, certainly in this case, when we look at things like the type of conduct that was engaged in here, the disparity in size between the assailant and the victim, the fact that this was a sustained assault, and I really bristle when this is referred to as parental discipline gone wrong.
I agree with all of that. And what I'm saying is, why isn't it okay to say to the jury, you may look at all of these circumstances to determine if this defendant had an indifference to...
I think it is okay to look at the facts and circumstances.
To see if there was an indifference.
To see if there was an indifference. And now we're getting into the non-party brief.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's fine. And we can talk about the non-party brief. Frankly, I was hoping that Professor Dickey would be here because I think I know what they are asking for, but I am not sure. And what I think they're asking for is somewhat different than what the Chief was suggesting.
Are you referring to page 10 of the...
Pages 10 and 11 of the non-party brief. I understand the professors to be proposing that the state be required to prove the following. One, that a very serious harm was risked.
As a serious harm was what?
Risked. That a very serious harm was risked. As opposed to death, which is the language that Mr. Fullen is proposing. Two, that the very serious harm, or that the very serious harm was very likely to occur, or that it had no social value, and three, circumstances show either the defendant's indifference or contempt to at least one of these facts. Now, this is the analytical framework that I understand the non-party brief to be advocating.
Okay,
a very serious harm. I'm sorry?
Do you agree with that?
I can live with it if we use that formulation. Okay, that if we use the alternative, that the very serious harm was either likely to occur or that it had no social value, and if the state can discharge its burden by showing either the defendant's indifference or contempt. Because it seems to me that there may be an element of inference from conduct that the state can draw in that set of circumstances. But the non-party brief specifically says that the standard does not require the state to prove any subjective awareness apart from what is required for simple recklessness. The non-party brief goes on to say that the defendant's indifference or contempt may include awareness of the harm, but it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to. So I find, for my part, I find that formulation of the non-party brief very useful. I don't see that as being a whole lot different from WESO. Now, I'm hesitant to speak for Professor Dickey and the others, but I think that that was what they were driving at. And if that is their interpretation of it, yes, it is something that the state would be able to work with.
Could you explain to me, I have a difficult time fashioning some kind of conduct where the defendant could claim, but my conduct had social value. Do you have an example for me?
Well, I do, and it's a hideous and outrageous one, but it seems to have come into play here. A defendant, almost always in an abusive situation, a child abuse situation, is going to say that this was done with parental discipline in mind. It's going to be represented as parental discipline. Now, the reality of the situation is we're not talking about parental discipline here. We're talking about an assault committed against a 2-month-old child. We're talking about a sustained assault. Discipline requires the child, the person receiving the discipline, to be able to understand that there's some behavior that needs to be corrected. Parental discipline is corrective behavior. This wasn't corrective behavior. This was an assault. Now, I could imagine that in some situations, a defendant might be able to argue or at least posit to a fact finder that there was some social utility in the conduct that was involved. That's not present here. That's not present here. I would ask this court to pay particularly close attention to the descriptions of the injuries. They're found at Record 54, at pages 13 and 14, Record 55, at pages 52 to 66, and Record 55 at pages 128 and 129. I want to answer Justice Prosser's question to Mr. Fullen. The question was, what was the time frame from the infliction of the injuries to the 911 call? I'm quoting from the record here, record item 55 at page 114. This is questioning of the defendant. The defendant said, in response to the question, how soon from the time that the child stopped crying until you called 911, how long? His response to that question was, I'd say no longer than 25 to 30 seconds. This is plainly cross-examination. The next question, when you called 911, you lied about what happened. Answer, yes, I did. So Justice Prosser, in response to your question, the time frame was 25 to 30 seconds. The lying began instantaneously to that.
Counsel, I want to focus on test. You were earlier, or just moments ago, discussing language set forth on page 10 of the non-party brief, and I understood you to say something like, I could live with this. And as I read the non-party brief, it had a couple of approaches. And the first approach it discussed was, what does this aggravated element mean? And is it aggravated with regard to harm? Is it aggravated with regard to risk? Is it aggravated with regard to lack of social value? That's their first approach, and they discuss that. Their second approach, and the one that I understood you to be focusing on, is that under the second approach, you don't need to show any elevated harm, no elevated risk, no elevated lack of social value, but the showing of an attitude of indifference or contempt, at least of one of these facts. Is that what you were referring to when you said, yeah, I could buy into that test, or am I mistaken?
No, you're not misunderstanding. I do believe that's the approach that they settled on in this.
Yes.
That they're not looking at elevated natures of the other factors, mm-hmm. but instead focusing on the attitude of indifference or contempt.
Yeah, that's what makes the aggravated. That's what it is they're settling on.
I understand them too.
And do you agree with that?
Yes. Yes, that is a formulation that I don't see as being fundamentally different from
this. Then I have a little problem, because that paragraph is right above the paragraph on page 10 that Mr. Fullan was buying into. And Mr. Fullan's paragraph is nothing more, as at least suggested by the writer of the non-party brief, than explaining the prior paragraph. So you're buying into the prior paragraph, he's buying into to this next paragraph, and the writer of the brief says they're both the same, it's just one's explaining the other.
Well, my paragraph is better.
Okay, that explains it. So I'm a little confused.
And I think my paragraph is a little better, because I include the remainder of the analysis that the amicus provide, and that is that there is no requirement of a subjective awareness. There can be. If subjective awareness is present in the formulation, then that can be taken into account in determining whether we're talking about indifference or contempt or both. But I don't see it as a bottom, the existence of a proof of subjective intent. I don't see it as a bottom. I don't think that the non-party participants do, but I think that Mr. Jensen does. And to that extent, we really part company with the defense in this case.
Well, your attitude of indifference or contempt comes from the last paragraph on page 11. As I read.
Yes,
on
page 11. Yes, Chief.
Explains why it's not a reasonable person standard or an objective standard. Their brief says it's not subjective, it's not objective. It's, you look at the circumstances, which you all in your argument haven't paid much attention to. You're looking at utter disregard, and you leave out that first clause.
Is there a question?
Yeah. Am I right?
Ask me again, please. I'm sorry.
Well, as I read the amicus brief, there's great emphasis on the whole clause, circumstances that show, etc. And you are asking in your brief for subjective test.
No, Chief.
Okay.
We're asking for objective.
I'm sorry. You're asking for objective, and the brief says objective doesn't help if you're talking about reasonable person standard, because it fails to make clear that the circumstances must show an attitude of indifference or contempt about one or more of the gravity of the harm, the likelihood of occurring, and its lack of social utility. So when I read that, it seems as if it's somewhere between objective and subjective, which is why they avoid using that term.
In truth, I think it leans more toward objective, because I don't see the analysis, the gravity of the harm, likeliness of it occurring, lack of social utility. I see that as another formulation of the WESO analysis. I see that as another formulation of the laundry list that the Court of Appeals used in the Edmonds decision in determining the totality of the circumstances. In that respect, I think that what the amicus is proposing here is much closer to the objective rather than the subjective standard. But I agree with you, it does seem to fall
somewhere in between. Because they say the subjective standard is in that first part of an awareness and the reckless. So where does that leave us if it's somewhere between objective and subjective? And I use somewhere between objective and subject, whatever those words mean.
The amicus approach if this court clarifies that it is neither pure objective or pure subjective, I think the amicus approach is a more workable, more simplistic approach. I think it's necessary, though, that if this court adopts the amicus approach, that they import in all of the analysis, including what the non-party participants had to say about it not being a subjective standard. In truth, the state in prosecuting these cases has been able to work with the utter disregard language as clarified by WESO. That certainly is our preference, but you know, in fairness, Mr. Pullen has pointed out cases where there has been a divergence of analysis, and clarity is always preferable.
I have a lot of difficulty with the jury instructions. I mean, I'm not sure that I would understand that.
Well, pattern instruction?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think 1250 adequately instructs the jury, with assuming that we adopt this new Dickey Posner-Weber standard? Fuller?
Thank you. Be sure to call Professor Dickey and tell him about that. No, I think the jury instructions committee would obviously look long and hard at a decision coming out of this.
So what kind of instruction would they give?
I think they would look at this language probably as a start. I think they would also look at Edmonds, the analysis that they give, the factors that they give in Edmonds at page 77. In truth, I haven't sat down and tried to draft out a jury instruction that would match the standard that the amicus brief is proposing. You know, plainly our office is involved in the jury instructions committee. I know Mr. Fullen's office is. It's my understanding that when case law revises the approach that needs to be taken in the substantive jury instructions, that they're put to committee, discussed, promulgated. Almost certainly there'd have to be some changes to 1250, but I'd want to sit down and think a little bit about what those would be.
What do you think that 1250 now does? Is it subjective, objective?
both?
In determining whether the conduct showed utter disregard for human life, you should consider all the factors relating to the conduct. These include the following: what the defendant was doing, why he was doing it, how dangerous it was, how obvious the danger was, and whether the conduct showed any regard for human life.
Well, since the instruction does not call either for actual knowledge or does it promulgate a reasonable person standard, it's silent with respect to whether it's an objective or subjective approach. I tend to think that the factor analysis, the reasonable factor analysis, the totality of the circumstances analysis is more of an objective than subjective, but they don't use that terminology.
If we were to adopt the Dickey, Posner, Weber, Fullan analysis, would we have to send this back for a new trial?
We talked about this in the moot court in preparation for the argument. I think that the court could go ahead and say this is the standard. We have a cold record here. We have fact-finding by the trial judge. And specifically, I'd ask you to look at record 56 at page 85, where Judge Fiedler says how obvious the danger was. I am satisfied that a reasonable person would recognize that activity of this type carries with it a significant risk of danger, and I am further satisfied that Mr. Jensen was aware of that at the time. We have a finding of fact that would satisfy, I think, even the most subjective standard that the defense could promote here. I would prefer, obviously, that the court evaluate the evidence under the standard and say it was met, that the evidence supported the verdict. By no stretch of the imagination should the court automatically reverse the judgment of conviction. The most that should happen here is that it should be remanded for fact-finding consistent with the new standard.
Counsel, would you read that portion again from Record 56, page 85? Is that what you said?
Yes. Record item 56, page 85. How obvious the danger was, semicolon, I am satisfied that a reasonable person would recognize that activity of this type carries with it a significant risk of danger, com, and I am further satisfied that Mr. Jensen was aware of that at the time, period.
One of my concerns, and don't know if it's central to anything here, but was the discussion raised by Mr. Fullan. It makes some sense to me. That is, is a reasonable person... That is, whether or not his client knew the kind of danger this behavior would cause. It wasn't until 1995 that I heard of the first case of shaken baby syndrome and case. Now, they may have, I just may have been slow. They may have been slow to hit central and northern Wisconsin, but that's the first time I heard of one. That's the first time I recall that in our courts we had one. And I note that a few courts around the state are opening up old cases because previously no one thought, and I'm now interjecting, previously no one thought of or heard of this kind of conduct. And now we're getting prosecutions years later because it's now well known. You know, I think it's reasonable that some people would not know a couple of years ago much about shaken baby.
How could a 5 foot, 10 inch, 135 pound young man, admittedly, but a man who'd been told that his child was vulnerable because of weak neck muscles, a man who was told that he needed to be careful when he held his child, how could a person under those circumstances not know that a violent assault, an assault sufficient to bring the child's head back and forward, striking the back and the chest, how could a reasonable person not know that that exposed the child to a risk of death? Now, we want, the defense plainly wants to focus on the shaken baby syndrome here, and that's fine. Actually, the first use of the syndrome was in 1972. What this is, as much as anything, when you strip away the terminology, when you strip away the title shaken baby syndrome, we have a violent, sustained assault by an adult against an infant. Now, whether we call it shaken baby syndrome or call it something else, the truth of the matter is that a rational fact finder could infer that this defendant must have known of the risk of death based on the severity of the violence that he inflicted on the child and the severity of the violence necessary to cause the injury. We have an amazing disparity in size here. It is useful to the defense in cases like this to say, well, no one knew about shaken baby syndrome, no one knew about the myelination process, no one knew about the tentorium and how the brain scrapes along. But a man in the defendant's position must be held to know that that kind of sustained assault places the child in risk of its life. Whether we say it's because of shaken baby syndrome or just because we have an adult beating on a child. For the court's reference, you may want to view or take a look at volume 92 of Pediatrics, December of 1993. You'll find the statement from the ABA, or the American Medical Association's Committee on Child Abuse and Neglect on Shaken Baby Syndrome. It's volume 92, Pediatrics, number 6, December of 1993.
Why do you want us to look at that?
As a medical background on shaken baby syndrome, I understood the question to address how things could reasonably be inferred. This is probably one of the better short summaries of the phenomenon.
My reason for my question is, I don't suppose that, well, I'll speak for myself, I've never looked at that journal, and I doubt that most people, including this defendant, haven't looked at the journal. So are we going to, what standard are we going to hold these people to?
We're not going to hold the defendant to Dr. Perloff's standard. But what we are going to do is say, yes, a 20-year-old adult male who weighs 5'10" and 135 pounds, a reasonable fact finder could look at that and say, yes, this person must have known.
Counsel, in some ways I find this question difficult because I consider it so reprehensible behavior, but we're talking about now a legal standard. If a 6-foot person would be shaking a 3-year-old back and forth out of instantaneous and blind anger or whatever, I mean, doing that, And then I'm going to take you to a 2-year-old, and then I'm going to take you to a 1-year-old, and then I'm going to take you to a 10-day-old. I'm assuming, I don't know this because I'm not educated on the syndrome, I'm assuming there's a different risk of life endangering.
Under
you don't have the same vulnerability.
Sure. More precisely, given the mechanics of brain development in children, there is a somewhat lessened risk of injury of the type that occurred here as the child gets older and as the child's brain formulates. The literature generally focuses on children who suffer from shaken baby syndrome from ages 5 and under. But this court in the past has never had difficulty looking at disparate relationships between aggressor and victim and drawing conclusions about what the defendant intended or must have known or should have known about the risks involved with their actions. I bristle at the notion that by placing a medical label or a medical term on a phenomenon, that we somehow imbue it with a level of sophistication that immunizes a defendant from criminal liability because he can come in and say, well, I didn't know what the physicians knew in this case. Plainly, he must have known, based on nothing other than the difference in size and the severity of the force that was necessary to cause these injuries, a reasonable fact finder could come back and say, yes, this person should have known, must have known, did know.
And that would be under an objective standard.
That would be under an objective standard.
Yeah, but you've already proved that.
Or a subjective standard.
You've already proved that. And before you even get to utter disregard, you've already shown that the defendant was aware that his conduct created such a risk. That's the other
Well,
point.
A risk, right. A risk of death or great bodily harm.
Right.
In the criminal recklessness conduct. I mean, I understand the defense's position here to be that, well, in order to sustain the plea to the original charge and for purposes of argument, well, yes, my man knew that what he was doing here caused risk of great bodily harm, but not death. And I'm saying that under the circumstances of this case, yes, death as well.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Fullen, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Judge Fiedler, in the paragraph that we've been looking at, on which appears at page 108 of the appendix to my brief, talks about how obvious the danger was. And that's the point in this case, how obvious the danger was. Judge Fiedler was satisfied that a reasonable person would recognize that activity of this type carries with it a significant risk of danger. And he is satisfied that Mr. Jensen was aware of that at the time. A risk of danger? Of course. Mr. Jensen had already pled to reckless child abuse. It was quite clear, and it was conceded, I think. This whole trial was about utter disregard. It was conceded before the final arguments in this case that second-degree reckless was not an issue in this trial. It was only whether it was first. And we're fortunate to have Judge Fiedler set forth on the record what he thought the danger was, and he goes, yes, a significant risk of danger. What this court needs to do is clarify that. A significant risk of fatal results. The statute says utter disregard for life, not safety, not danger, life. And so the proper standard, properly applied, and if this court clarifies, juries will be instructed, and Judge Fiedler and others like him will have the benefit of that, is that how obvious the danger was refers to a risk of death, a fatal risk. And I think on this record, it's difficult to draw an inference that Mr. Jensen knew that shaking CD could kill him. It's very difficult to draw that inference.
Counsel,
go ahead.
Your opposing counsel says he bristles at the idea that you espouse because it engenders relying on ignorance. And indeed, the non-party brief indicates that one of the approaches that it sets forth is subject to criticism. One may lack subjective awareness of the greater risk, but be equally blameworthy as where one does not make the effort to consider the extreme risk.
I don't know that an effort is what we're talking about.
Well, but you heard what your opposing counsel said.
I think what he bristled at is the idea this was parental discipline, and you know, I don't know if this is parental discipline, but the circumstances of this were a loving father and an uncontrollable baby. They were not in Miso. It was a bar fight. They were drunk. One of them got out a knife and swung it at the other. That isn't what this was. So I don't say there's social utility to this, but I do think it's understandable, and we're talking about culpability here.
Yeah, your argument brought in what some of your colleagues thought they would do to your children, and that's what I think counsel was maybe bristling at. But my question is this. Justice Bradley gave an example of going through this from the years from a two-month-old child to a 10-month to a three-year-old. And obviously, what's wrong with this is what the jury hears. And I think at some point, there certainly is a difference of how a reasonable jury in an objective standard would consider a two-month-old child and a six-year-old child as far as the parent handling that child.
And the same is true under a subjective standard. I mean, you have to look at the total circumstances and you have to draw an inference about what this defendant knew. Now, you want to see a reasonable person would have known, fine, but that's irrational because intent requires intent to kill. And recklessness requires awareness that of a substantial unreasonable risk of death or great bodily harm. So we have subjective culpability standards for both intent and simple recklessness. Now we've got something in between. It's worse than simple recklessness. We're going to say it doesn't matter what he knew? No. It doesn't make any sense to say what a reasonable person have known. That puts a totally unsubjective factor into here. And I think if we want to have gradations of culpability based on the moral reprehensibility of the conduct, a piece of that should be the defendant's subjective awareness. Juries can infer intent, juries can infer recklessness, juries can infer aggravated recklessness. But they should be told that you must actually have an indifference or contempt for the risk. And then they infer it or they don't. I think the Hoyt case, H-O-Y-T, was reversed. It was a battered women case, but I remember Professor Remington telling me, this is a good example, that case got reversed because Mrs. Hoyt could have been convicted because the jury saw that the circumstances were such, and they were never really clearly told that she had to intend.
Thank you, Mr. Fullen. Thank you, Mr. Posey-Webber. That completes our argument in 98-3175-0, and it completes our March calendar. For the first 3 days in April, we